Well, Gavin, great to have you. We had Gavin here a couple of years ago, so it's really fantastic that you decided to come back and see us again. So I thought the first thing we could do is you could start by telling us a bit about your background. You grew up not too far from here. No. So tell us about growing up in this area and your dad.
Sure, yes. I'm pretty much a local boy in many respects, southeast London-ish, born in Welling, right near Elton, Shooter's Hill actually. My dad, Keith, was a professional footballer for Charlton Athletic for 17 years, a one-club man. That's pretty unusual nowadays. And my dad holds the record for the most outfield appearances of any player in Charlton's history. There's one player that appeared more times, and he was a goalkeeper, Sam Bartram. So my dad has that distinguished record, and he's also the first substitute ever used in English league football. So I always say, back in the day when men were men, you know what I mean? Like 11 v 11, and you got an injury, you broke a leg, you ran it off because you were tough, and there was no substitute. So the FA obviously looked at it, thought, you know, we need to bring in, you know, an extra man, and then managers can make tactical changes as well for injuries or whatever reason. On that day, 1965, I think it was August 1965, my dad was a few years into his professional career, and he was the 12th man substitute on the day. And after, 8 minutes, the Charlton goalkeeper, Mike Rose, got injured, and they put the defender in goal and brought my dad on the field. He was clocked as the first substitute ever used. And that's actually a Trivial Pursuit question in European Trivial Pursuit. My dad hates it because he says, I played more times than anyone else in Charlton's history. I get remembered for not being good enough to be in the starting lineup on one particular day. But, you know, my mum's there in the picture. Mum and dad, solid marriage, still married today, 50-odd years. Childhood sweethearts, and my sister and I grew up in a loving home. But I was brought up around the smell of the dressing room, the valley, and just wanting to follow in my dad's footsteps. And you see there, up in the top right, there was just a few months ago, my dad and I at the valley together. But I went through the ranks, and my dad was a great coach, never forced me, but was always there to give me good coaching and advice. So I had the example, I had the coaching, and I had the motivation to pursue the schoolboy dream.
Wonderful, wonderful. This next slide is of our youth group. You went to a youth group that was about half a dozen young people, not unlike our youth group, and you were making inroads into football, had your nice little car.
Yep.
And yet, tell us about what happened when you turned up to that youth group and kind of what happened thereafter.
Yes.
And here's a quote here that's quite interesting that you I picked up.
I went through the normal procedure to become a professional footballer. You get, you know, you're good at school, then it's district, then it's county. At age 15, I played for England under schoolboy, under 15s, and that was schoolboys. And I had lots of clubs wanted to sign me. I signed for Queen's Park Rangers, and I left school at 16 to sign professional forms with them. So I've got it. I've got the schoolboy dream. I've got a bit of money in my pocket. I've got a nice car. It was an XR3i, Ford XR3i, a real 80s car. I had the 80s hair to go with it. I had this career. I had the schoolboy dream. But it wasn't really satisfying because, as I say, football was my god. And if I played well, I was up. If I played bad, I was down. So I'm going through this period where I'm about 17, 18 years old. I was living at home with mum and dad. And I'm thinking, right, this is all that the world says will make you happy. And I've got that, but I'm not truly happy. I'm wrestling with this. And one night my mum just said, oh, I'm going to go along to the local church tonight. It was Barnhurst Methodist Church. So this time we'd moved from Welling to Barnhurst. And my dad was now the manager of Gillingham Football Club in Kent. So he retired and he was a manager. And I was a young professional footballer. And the minister said to me, do you fancy coming back to my house afterwards? I have a youth meeting, very similar to that, half a dozen young people your age. And I walked into the room that night, and I've got everything. I'm in the in crowd. These guys didn't have everything. They weren't necessarily in the in crowd. But when they spoke about Jesus Christ, And when they prayed, there was a joy and a reality they had that I did not have. And then over the next few weeks, I heard the minister unpack what is the gospel, the good news of what God has done to save people like us through the life, death, and resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ. And I realized that my biggest issue wasn't to get the approval of the crowd on a Saturday, but it was to be in a right relationship with the living God, against whom I'd sinned, under whose judgment I was, and yet because of his great grace and mercy, had provided this way back through Jesus Christ. And I believed upon Christ. I was saved at age 18, and so now, all of a sudden, football wasn't God anymore. Christ is God, as he is, and football fell into its right place. And then, you know, I could enjoy football, because football's good, but it is not God. And actually then, I enjoyed my football better, and I think I played better as well, right, because I had perspective.
Great, great. We'll come back to football itself. But then a certain young lady came into your life. So when did you get married?
So it's interesting. So I got saved. I became a Christian. And then I was going to SIDCUP adult education classes to do my history A level. So Dad was sensible. My dad said, like, you know, you could lose your career in one tackle in training. You need to just, you did your GCSEs, but you left school, so why don't you do your A-levels at night school? I'm doing history A-level, first night of a class, in walks Amanda, and the only space available was, you know, kind of like that, one space. She sat next to me, right there at the table, and I thought, oh, I like her. I like her smile. She's a pretty girl. I'll talk to her at the break, and then we got chatting, and she said, so what do you do then? And I thought, I've got the killer line here. I'm a professional footballer, right? You've got to get the girls, right? So I said, I'm a professional footballer. She said, I don't really like football at all. So that was God humbling me, and my chat-up line was out the window. But then I started to tell her about my life. I told her I was a Christian. She was very interested in Christianity. She had been looking around, searching herself at the time, and we quite liked each other. We weren't going out or anything, but I said, why don't you come to my church and to this youth group? And so Amanda started coming along, and after you know, a few weeks and months, she believes upon Jesus, and she was saved and became Christian too. So from the time of 18, we'd known each other, and you know, it was one of those situations where she got saved after me, and a couple of years later we were dating, and then we were married within 9 months, I think. But I asked Amanda to go out, and then we were married pretty quick.
Don't hang around.
I got a transfer to Bournemouth to play for Harry Redknapp, and I said, we need to get married. And so we started life on the South Coast. But so, married on a Sunday. Listen to this one. I played football on a Saturday, scored for Bournemouth against Blackburn Rovers, my first goal, drove back up to Barnhurst on the Saturday night, married Amanda on the Sunday, had our wedding reception at Maidstone Dartford Football Club, because we got a deal there because we were in football. It was a cheapy wedding. Drove halfway back to Bournemouth on our wedding night, and she drove me into training the next day because Harry Redknapp wouldn't give me the day off, because we were playing Port Vale at home on the Tuesday. And my poor wife must have thought, what have I got myself into here?
It sounds like life was wonderful, but tell us about you and Jake.
Yes, so we went from Bournemouth. After a year, we went to Newcastle, and things really exploded for me on the football field. You know, I was top scorer for Newcastle. I was playing well. Top clubs were looking at me. Newcastle itself is a big club. And under Kevin Keegan, we got promotion to the Premier League. And at the same time in that promotion season, Amanda fell pregnant with Jake. And as I say, a wonderful season. We won promotion, and we went around the city of Newcastle in one of these open-top bus rides, and there was about 150,000 Geordies lying in the streets, and I was captain, and you know, life couldn't get better, really. I had a contract, a captain, we're in the Premier League, Amanda's about to give birth, and then she went into labour literally a few days after that, and it was very painful, 2 days, and literally gave enough time for family to hear that she was going into labour and get up from London to Newcastle, and everyone's waiting. And after 2 days of labour, literally, Jake was born, and we just wanted to see if it was a boy or a girl. I saw it was a boy, and then he cried. And you can see there, he put his arm out to the side, and I saw he was born with one hand. It was a complete shock. We only had one scan in those days, and it may be the way he was lying, it didn't show. But it's amazing, you know, you can go from the highest you've ever felt and the happiest to you're rocking now, and the shock, and they took him to the side, and with limb deficiency issues, there could be other issues with heart and lungs. But it's amazing because even in that moment, our faith in Jesus Christ, strengthened us to know that God is sovereign and God is in control, no matter what's going on down here, even things you can't understand and suffering. And the doctor, I don't think he was a Christian, said, this is the body that God has given Jake. And you saw that picture there of him ripped on the left here. He's actually now, he owns a gym, he's married for 4 years now, he's 26, owns a gym in Calgary where he trains kids and all ages. And he actually fights professional kickboxing. And he's fighting in Dublin in a couple of weeks' time. So go to see him fight. In a sport you think you need two hands for, he's competing at a top level. And he loves the Lord, as does our daughter Ava. There's pictures now of our family. I'm walking Ava down the aisle there a couple of years ago, top right. That's our daughter Ava. She's 23. Some of you here might remember Jake and Ava when they were tiny. There's a couple of friends from our old church there. There's Jake with his wife Krista. And there's the four of us down there as a family. And we live out in Calgary, Alberta now, in Canada.
Excellent. Back to the football. Mm-hmm. Tell us about these teams. 18 years you were a Premiership footballer?
Yeah, well, not all in the Premiership. 18 years as a pro, 600 plus games. These are the three biggest teams, though I've had some few appearances. My dad said to me, my dad, is the most appearances in Charlton's history and an outfield player. I am the least, because I went to Charlton and I played something like two appearances in a 3 month loan spell up and I got injured after the second appearance. So, Newcastle United, Chelsea, and QPR. I had two spells at QPR, started my career there in the 80s, finished in early 2000s. 10 years there I played, and QPR in some ways is my first love. Chelsea, I played my biggest games for, scoring against Manchester United, scoring in every round up to the FA Cup final in 94, captaining them in the European run to the semi-finals in 1995, and playing with some of the best players in the world. And then Newcastle United, before the Chelsea adventure, was where I think I scored maybe my most goals. I played for Aussie Idealism, Kevin Keegan, who were just brilliant managers.
I think we can see, you talk about playing with some of the best players in the world. I think hopefully we can get you seeing you score one of those
Ruth
goals.
Ruth Hullett,
yes. Oh, volume.
Yeah. Oh, I could do commentary. I used to do that. That's Ruth Hullett. There's me. I'm deadly from inside the 6 yard box. Don't miss me. But Ruth Hullett was just a supreme player, former world footballer of the year, AC Milan, Holland, and you just see here, he just leaves people for dead in his pace. But he always knew how to do the right thing. He could have taken a shot there, he drew the keeper and just rolled it, and so it was easy for me to put it in the back of the net. When Ruud Gullit came to Chelsea in my final season, we went on to another level, and after Ruud, then the really top players came in, Zola, Gianfranco Zola and others.
I think I could have scored that one.
Oh, you could. I fell over, did you see? I was actually falling over and I just knocked it in.
So. Now, so what's it like to score a...
You couldn't have scored that one, right? I'm just looking at the ground I had to make up from the halfway line to get there. If you'd had a taxi...
I didn't see that bit.
Someone, if you'd had a taxi from the halfway line to the penalty box and they'd like drop you off, you might have scored.
Now, I love this quote. I can still feel the electricity and euphoria of the moment. It's the kind every boy in England dreams of experiencing. The goal gave us the lead over Man United. Sorry for any Man United fans. A lead we never relinquished. We beat them 1-0, both at home and away that season. 93-94. A rare feat against the best team in the country. And I scored the winning goal each time. Here comes a bit I really want you to talk about. God made me a Christian, but he also made me a footballer. And when I played, I felt his pleasure. as the great Eric Liddell once said. We'll talk about a bit about that. I like that the last bit at the end there.
Yeah, sure. I mean, my first season at Chelsea, I did score the winner against Manchester United home and away. The second game was at Old Trafford, and it was, you know, in the theatre of dreams, as it were. And it is the point of the game to score and to win, and it's a thrilling thing to score. And one of the things I loved playing football for was it was to actually give a thrill to the fans. But also, God, as I say, God made me first as a Christian, but he made me a footballer. He puts us in all different walks of life, and he gives us gifts and talents to use for his glory. And there's a wisdom in that, in how we use them, that actually then reflects back to God. So as a Christian, it's great, because you not only do your job for excellence for yourself and family, you do it to display glory, the glory of God in the gifts he's given you. And so there's a certain thrill and pleasure I felt in that, as scoring the goal was putting that kind of wisdom of God on display. And Eric Liddell, you know, maybe you know the story of Eric Liddell, the great Scottish runner, former rugby player, who went on to become a missionary in China. He won the Olympics in Paris in 400 metres. And he was allegedly said that, you know, God made me for China, to be a missionary in China, but he also made me fast, and when I run, I feel his pleasure. And I think that's the way that we as Christians can really have a deeper joy in our work and whatever we're gifted to do, as we feel the pleasure of God in doing what he's given us to do in this world to the best of our ability, to his glory. And that can be in whatever you do.
And it wasn't just your dad who got the record being the first substitute and playing so many games, but this next clip showed that you got a record as well.
Yeah, this is a third goal, my hat-trick against Middlesbrough at Stamford Bridge in 1996, February 96. And we beat them 5-0. It was a supreme team performance on the day. Glenn Hoddle was manager and said it was the best he'd seen the Chelsea team play for that day. And it worked out that it was the first hat-trick from a Chelsea player in the Premiership. Now, bear in mind, the Premiership only been going 2 or 3 years by then. Other players have scored hat-tricks for Chelsea, but this is the first Premiership hat-trick. Since then, only Frank Lampard and Tammy Abraham, as Englishmen, have scored hat-tricks for Chelsea. So it's nice to be in that elite company. Even to this day.
It's a great record. No one could beat that record. The first one.
To be the first.
Yeah. No, it's great. Great. Okay. And tell us about some of these guys.
So these are four of my managers. I'll start with the guy at the bottom. I'll start with the guy at the top there. That's Terry Venables, middle centre. Terry Venables actually signed me for QPR in the mid 1980s. And Terry was the reason I signed for QPR, really, over Tottenham or Arsenal, because he was such a great manager, a bright young manager, and I wanted to play for Terry Venables. And it was only, sadly for me, he was only there a few months before he went to Barcelona. Obviously, he went on to manage England. And when I did get to Chelsea, and I was probably at the peak of my career, Terry brought me into two England training squads. So I never got a full England cap, but I was kind of on the edge there when Terry was manager. Jim Smith is the guy down the bottom. He's recently died, actually, just literally a few months ago. Called, nicknamed affectionately in the game, the Bald Eagle. He gave me my debut for QPR when I was 19. So actually, I would say a few months after I became a Christian, he gave me my debut. And then a few years later, ended up buying me when he was manager of Newcastle. So it took me up to Newcastle. It was very influential in my career. Good football man, great knowledge of the game. Used to shout and scream a little bit, old school, send a cup of tea flying across the dressing room. But he put his arm around you, and at the end of the day, he was good. Harry Redknapp, I played for it at Bournemouth. I said a man and I got married and went down there. Obviously, you'll know him from, is it Celebrity Get Me Out of Here? He's becoming even more famous now for that. But Harry was quite a young manager then, and he knew football well, and he knew how to spot players and bring them together and put them in a team. So Harry was quite inspiring to play for. And then there's Glenn Hoddle on the right there. he was, I would say, the most tactically astute manager I played for. A great visionary. Any of you who ever watched Glenn play as a player when he was playing for Tottenham Hotspur would see what an amazing passer of football and pictures he saw on the field. When he saw them off the field, and he came into Chelsea Football Club and had a vision to turn this team into something that was really put the building blocks in place for what the team is today. That's not to say anything of Kevin Keegan and Ozzy Ardiles and others, but I was very privileged to play for some of the great managers of the game, who were also some of them great footballers, and to learn many wisdom things from them, the art of leadership as well.
Great. So you kind of mixed with football royalty. I mean, there are some well-known players, managers there. And yet, you left football and started doing working for Match of the Day, being a pundit. But this next quote, I think, is quite interesting, because you started to think about the Bible and theology. Mm. So let me read this. This is quite funny. I remember being on Match of the Day 2 on a Sunday night, and then driving up to Cambridge the following day for Old Testament studies, and all the lads in the class with me, all trained to be parsons and vicars, just wanted to talk about the football. The teacher is discussing the book of Genesis, and there are guys next to me saying, "I can't believe you hammered Arsenal on TV last night," and asking me what Alan Shearer was like. So you're still a Match of the Day 2, yeah, but you're driving to Cambridge?
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about that and the transition out from
right. Yeah, so my media career really took off for me. I wasn't the biggest name ever to retire from football and go into it, but it was going well at the BBC. I got my foot in the door. I was doing BBC 5 live commentaries. I was doing Football Focus, Final Score, Match of the Day. Match of the Day 2 was a real niche for me. And I was going to World Cups, and I went to the World Cup in Germany in 2006. And around that time, I just started to feel a strong internal sense or call to maybe preach the Bible, to lead in the church. And now I've spoken evangelistically, but I never had a sense that this might be a vocational thing for me. And so this was a subjective internal thing, so how you investigate that. I spoke to the leadership in my church, a few guys here from the church there. The vicar was Richard, and I spoke to him, and he said, "You know, I see certain things. I'll give you some opportunities to preach. You might want to look at doing some studies as well." So that's why I was going to Cambridge as well. And so I was had my media career, but then I was investigating the other side of what it might look like to move towards church ministry. Once I started preaching, and once I started studying the Bible, I said to Amanda, "I think I'm going to give it up." Like that's the second dream career, really, in many ways, the media. People will think I'm crazy, but I think I want to take a little bit of time to prepare rightly for something that is so weighty and serious. And so I told the head of football at BBC that I was going to leave it, and I was going to take some time out to prepare for church ministry and do my master's studies, which I ended up doing in Calgary, Alberta. Briefly, the reason we went there, I could have done it here, but my profile was very high in the UK. And I thought, what would it look like to go to anonymity where no one really cared what I did in football, but they would just hear what I had to say from the Bible? We knew Calgary a bit, we'd been going there, and so we said, well, let's go. We'll do a 3-year thing there. It would be a real life test for us as well. We talked our children through it. We said, you know, that you can't, it was a good chance to help them see life under God's sovereignty. That even good things like school and family and your country, they can be taken away, but Jesus Christ can't, and he's with you here or there. We left in 2008, and I finished my studies. I was preaching all the time, and then got offered a position. And I'm an associate pastor in a church called Calvary Grace Church in Calgary, Alberta, right now.
Yeah. But, and that transition, living there all the way away from here, was that easy?
Toughest dozen years of our lives. You know, I was 40 years old when I left this country. We were both 40 years old. And we had young children, 15 and 12 were the ages. So they're not easy ages. Lots of family, lots of friends, really good life here. And then all of a sudden, I'm like getting up at 6 in the morning to drive in at minus 20 degrees in Calgary to study Hebrew and Greek. And I'm thinking, I was sitting on the Match of the Day couch. It's nice and warm and comfortable there. But that aside, you know, just emigrating, just settling in a new country, get to know how a new culture does things. And that's an English-speaking culture with a lot of commonality to us here. It's still very, very difficult. But God has been good, and our faith has grown and deepened, and our children have grown to love Jesus. They're Christians, and so we see that really we didn't give up anything in the end, because He's only blessed us in even a greater amount. And now the wonderful thing is gone to anonymity, and yet God has created an aspect of my ministry where I've had opportunities to take a lead pastor position, but He's created aspects where I can actually travel and speak quite a lot. So I'm just a pastor in the local church. That's all I am. But I actually get opportunities to come, and I get to the UK about 6 weeks a year, go to Africa, China, preach the gospel and speak on many different issues of Christian faith.
Great, great. It's quite a contrast, though. So this is another quote. My first appearance for QPR was against Sheffield Wednesday in 86 on the plastic pitch. I was really nervous. Regarding my preaching debut, I had an evening service. 15 to 20,000 watched my debut for QPR, but there was about 15 in the church on that Sunday evening. But I was probably more nervous, because they say that when you're preaching, you're doing it to an audience of one. You're preaching for God. It's preaching to people, but to honour God. And I've always felt the weight of that. So there's quite a contrast between your playing for thousands and preaching to tens.
Oh, very much. I think people still find that hard to understand. And I mean, that's my daily. I played at nearly 100,000 at Wembley. And yet it's still, when I get up to preach, the word of God is His word. And there is that responsibility before Him. And you're preaching to people, obviously, but it's His word through a preacher to them. So to have that vertical perspective brings home the real seriousness of the task. And there's eternity at stake, as I'll talk about after the break. But yeah, 15 on my preaching debut. I was telling a couple of the guys, it was at St. Michael's Church in Wilmington. And I think Richard, the vicar, said, "We'll put you on an evening one, because there's only 15 people, and I'll limit the damage that you can do." And I remember getting up there, and I was preaching from the book of Galatians. So it's not easy to preach. You know, I could speak on television in front of millions, but like, how do I make this Bible passage and understand it, and then preach it so that people can understand it, and it's helpful? And Richard, he was a big guy, and he would sit there and he listened to you, you know, he'd close his eyes when he was really intently listening to you. So I'm preaching away, and I've only got like 20 minutes to do it. And I looked at him, he's closed his eyes, and I thought, he's listening hard here. And all of a sudden, his arm just dropped, boom, like that, into the middle of the aisle. And I've gone, he's fallen asleep. He actually fell asleep in the first sermon. So another humbling experience. Probably a few things to work on my preaching.
But I love this quote. Again, apologies to the Man United fans, but scoring against Man United was great, but ministry in Jesus' name has been better.
Is better, yeah.
Now, you're not just a footballer and a pundit, but you're also an author. Tell us about what's it like being an author? A co-author, I should say.
I mean, I didn't...
And why this book?
Yeah, sure. Well, firstly, I never thought I'd be sort of authoring books and theology books at that. But again, you know, God has opened doors where I never would have seen them. Dr. Ollie Strachan there he's a professor of theology in Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. He was also the president of CBMW, that's the Council on Biblical Manhood and Womanhood, what the Bible teaches about manhood and womanhood and marriage. He asked me to come on board at CBMW. It's just a voluntary thing to teach on these issues of biblical sexuality, which are key issues of our day in fact, and we wrote a book, and this is a really just a primer, Q-level book, on a whole thing of what the Bible says about manhood, womanhood, created in the image of God, equal but different physically and functionally in certain areas of life, in the home and the church, and all moving into areas of marriage and homosexuality, transgenderism, these issues that we're dealing with in the church today. Oh, and I wrote that a few years ago, and we've got three other books coming out in a couple of months' time. What does the Bible teach about lust? What does the Bible teach about homosexuality? And what does the Bible teach about transgenderism? And we've specifically zeroed in what does the Bible teach? Because we need to return to the sufficiency and authority of the scriptures in what they say on these things. Not that medical science doesn't have anything to say, but we need to root ourselves as the church in the Bible.
Great, excellent. So tomorrow, Gavin's going to be speaking on gender in the 21st century, both morning and afternoon at a local church. There's some flyers over there. And then Sunday morning, he's going to be at a church called Grace Church Sydenham, teaching the Bible again at 10:30 in the morning. Again, there's a flyer over there. And then he'll be here at Crofton Park on Sunday afternoon, Who is Jesus? 4 o'clock here at Grace Church Broccoli. We've probably just got time for. It's not been without controversy. There was this bit of backlash, but what would you say about that?
Yes, I was doing a conference in our church in Calgary about biblical marriage and the roles within a marriage, and basically from the book of Ephesians. I tweeted out three tweets on a husband leading his wife lovingly, that marriage is complementary, not competitive. And the third one was from Ephesians 5 about the wife willingly submitting to her husband's leadership. And I went to bed and I woke up the next day and my Twitter feed had exploded. I mean, I would get, you know, if... three or four people might like a tweet normally. Well, this thing went mad. My feed got hit about a million times because the press had got hold of it, secular press had got hold of it, and, you know, out of context had said, you know, this is sexist, this is wrong, and all of this. And so it blew up. I was able to then, I don't respond, but I was able to write a piece on it, a considered piece, showing how this is in the Bible and how marriage is actually a beautiful picture of Christ and the church. Yeah. And it was a good evangelistic opportunity.
Great.
So that's the way that went.
We thought we'd just give you a couple of minutes. Maybe there's a question you've been dying to ask Gavin Peacock when he's here. So who would like to ask a question before we have a break for you to refill and maybe grab something to eat, and then we'll get into the second part of the evening.